Good afternoon, everybody. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, May 9th. I'm Alan Chartok. Congressman John Faso, a Republican from New York's 19th District, is in the studio today. His district encompasses all or parts of 11 counties in the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, Catskills, and Central New York. Have a question for Congressman Faso? Now's your chance. Give us a ring. We're expecting a ton of calls on today's program, so get yours in early. The number is 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. 2551, where civility is the most important thing. Congressman John Faso, your calls. More coming up right after this news. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Vox Pop. Today, we welcome Congressman John Faso of New York's 19th District to the program. His district encompasses all or parts of 11 counties in the Capital Region, Hudson Valley, Catskills, and Central New York. The first-term Republican serves on the House Budget, Agriculture, and Transportation and Infrastructure Committees. He's a former Republican leader of New York State Assembly, also graduated from SUNY Brockport and Georgetown University Law Center. He lives in Kinderhook. John Faso, welcome to the Vox Pop. And before we go, I want you to straighten your tie because you are being video is available of this. If somebody goes to WAMC.org, you can watch John on your video screen now. So, okay. The number
Thanks,
to call,
Alan.
You're welcome, John. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. As you might imagine, John, the phones are loaded. You suggested you keep your answers short, and I hope that the people who are calling will keep their questions. Sure.
I'll try to be succinct. Great to be with you and your listeners.
Oh, thank you for that, John. Appreciate that very much. Okay, now we're going to go to start out with Mariana in Willow, New York. Mariana, you're on.
Hi. I just wanted to point out that I think President Obama made a good point the other night when he talked about how courageous Democrats were when they voted in favor of the ACA. So I wonder why Congressman Faso couldn't exhibit the same courage when this bill is opposed by the entire medical community, didn't have a CBO rating, only 17% of Americans approve of the legislation, and most people in his district are opposed to it. So that is my question.
Okay, John.
Well, Mariana, thanks for the call. CBO, we had a CBO score in March. Every action, every amendment that's been made to the bill since March has been intended to address many of the things that the CBO raised as concerns. I share some of those concerns. I think also, though, you have to keep in mind a couple of things. One, when they passed the ACA, and I'm talking about the final passage, they didn't have a CBO score on the final passage. This is just the initial passage in the House. We're going to get a CBO score on the revised legislation, and the Senate is going to have a CBO score as well. On the fact of the groups that may be supporting or opposing it, it's true many of the people that are in medical groups and medical establishment groups are concerned and have shared those concerns. I've listened to many of those concerns. I think many of those concerns can be addressed. The overwhelming thing for me is to try to preserve the coverage for people that got coverage on the exchanges and to protect people on the Medicaid expansion, but at the same time, address the real danger and the real fact and crisis that many people are simply priced out of the market now. And remember, when they passed the ACA, they said, if you like your plan, you can keep it. Turned out that wasn't true. And they said, if you like your doctor, you can keep it. That often wasn't true either. So there were good things and bad effects of the ACA. And what we're trying to do is address those. I don't think this bill is perfect. There are pieces of it that I don't necessarily agree with or I'd like to see change. And I'm confident that as we go forward, we can try to come forward with something that many more people in the country will see, particularly if we can lower premiums and deductibles.
Thank you, Mariana. Okay, we'll go to Charles in Averill Park. Okay, Charles, you're on.
Hello. Representative Faso.
Hi, Charles.
I understand that the Obamacare doesn't cover all Americans, and because it relies on private profit incentives for it to work, insurance companies can determine whether to offer insurance in given markets and at what prices. So the fix would be to try to correct those deficiencies. So the legislation that I was anticipating would be one that would cover at least the same number of Americans as Obamacare does, provides the same level of coverage, and does so at a lower cost to them. But the House bill takes health insurance away from 20 4 million or so Americans that Obamacare actually covered, raises everyone's insurance costs by about an average of $1,500. It cuts $880 billion from critical Medicaid services. It provides insurers a clear opportunity to exclude coverage or make that coverage prohibitively expensive, thereby making it, for example, and this is in my personal life, next to impossible for individuals with pre-existing conditions to avoid the protections that they need, all while delivering a $600 billion tax break to wealthy individuals and corporations without any consideration of this break on a federal budget deficit. And the House passed this by 4 votes, one of which was yours. So could you please explain voting for this bill, which harms the financial and health interests of so many of your constituents? Thank you.
Well, Charles, thank you for the call. You have a lot in that question, but let me address a couple of the issues you've raised. Number one, pre-existing conditions are covered in this bill. There's no change from the ACA with one minor exception where a state in a very limited circumstance could ask for a waiver, and we can get into this later. But this waiver, by the way, would not apply to New York State because these provisions are already covered under New York law. But if you were in a state that was able to receive a waiver, it would affect approximately 7 to 10% of the market in the individual and small group market. It wouldn't affect anyone on Medicaid or Medicare or TRICARE, which serves the military, or if you work for a state or local government or a school district. And it doesn't apply to people that work for large employers over 50. So I think that there's been a lot of distortion of the pre-existing condition provisions. But I would tell you that the pre-existing conditions are largely just what they are in the ACA. And take a look at the Washington Post, which decried some of the outright falsehoods that are being made and leveled by people against the legislation. They gave it 4 Pinocchios, which is their highest rating of falsehood. So there are a lot of things that were wrapped in your question, Charles. I know we'll get to those. But I think the bottom line for me is that, yes, many people were benefited by the ACA, but there were a lot of people that weren't. And there are a lot of people that have coverage now that is unaffordable, and people have seen their private plans change, and they've seen their deductibles skyrocket along with premiums. So what we're trying to do is address those issues that are real and apparent. And, you know, I expect premiums that are going to dramatically increase again this year in New York State because of the unraveling of the ACA markets around the country.
Charles, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. We'll go to Dave in Sullivan County. All right, Dave, you're on.
Yeah. Hi, Alan. Hey. Hi, Congressman.
Hi, Dave.
In your district, obviously. I'll ask the question and then give you a little bit of context. I'm trying to understand how the Congressional Budget Office could have gotten it so wrong and you and your colleagues gotten it so right with respect to read not long ago the CBO's recent report, I believe it's March 13th of this year, where they, along with the Joint Committee on Taxation, their assessment is that the insurance markets throughout the country are likely to be stable going forward. And I know that for lack of a better way to put it, the rallying cry from you and the caucus have been that the markets are imploding, unraveling, et cetera, et cetera. It's the kind of thing that drives a lot of us nuts. You know, you've got the CBO, which is not exactly a partisan entity, saying that what they say in their report, and then we're hearing essentially the exact opposite from you guys. So maybe you can help me understand that.
Sure. So, Dave, it's a very good question. A couple of points I'd make. When they passed the ACA on final passage, as I mentioned before, they didn't have a CBO score. The CBO score that came out in March said that potentially up to 24 million people could lose coverage. However, a couple of things about the CBO. They are, and I've not criticized them, because they can only analyze the bill that's in front of them. They can't also consider the other changes that are being expected in regulation. They have to only look at the bill in front of them. And so they said there could be as many as 24 million lose coverage. Every change that we have made to the legislation has been intended to address the impacts of that CBO score. For instance, the 50 to 64 age bracket, we have put an $80 billion fund to subsidize the coverage for people in the individual and small group market who might be adversely affected by the age banding, which is would be 5-to-1 under this legislation. 50 to 64 years old, $80 billion to lower premiums for those people. We also put in a special $15 billion fund to address the 18 fiscal year, there were 2018 and 2019 premium increases. CBO, if you remember, when you looked at that report, they said under the new legislation, premiums would go down by 2026 by about 10%, if not higher. But they said in 18 and 19, there was a potential that premiums could go up. So what we did is we put in a $15 billion federally funded reinsurance pool that will allow insurers to lower premiums and deductibles for the great majority of people in the country. So these were examples of things that we did, and there are a number of other examples of things that we did that specifically would address what CBO had alerted us to. Now, lastly, I would just point out that CBO, they're very capable folks, but they're not omnipotent. By this point in the ACA, they said 23 million people would be on the exchanges getting coverage. It actually is less than half that. It's fewer than 9 million people on the exchanges getting coverage. So CBO has a difficult job because they're trying to project a legislation that has many moving parts. They're, for instance, projecting that there would be large losses because of Medicaid in the first 2 years. In actuality, I don't think that is going to be correct at all, because the Medicaid expansion is funded fully, and states can put people on the Medicaid expansion right through the end of 2019.
Dave, I'm so sorry, but we have to take a break. I appreciate your call, and thanks again. Okay, we're going to take a short break.
Support for WMT comes from Bassett Healthcare, providing information on partial knee replacement at educational seminars across central New York. Dates and locations at saynotoneepain.com. Grapes and Grains Wine and Spirits, East Greenbush, New York, offering wine and craft spirits from around the globe and from local artisans. Hand-picked selection of wines, single malts, and small batch bourbons, grapesandgrainswine.com. The Waldorf School of Saratoga Springs, giving children the education and tools for the challenges of an ever-changing world. WaldorfSaratoga.org. Elements Hot Tub Spa, downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, offering hot tubs in 5 indoor or outdoor private rooms, plus a team of massage therapists for individuals and couples. ElementsHotTubSpa.com for gift certificates and photo gallery. And the Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, and Sunday, 12 to 5. HydeCollection.org.
Thank you, Zachary. We are back with Congressman John Faso. We go to Nancy in Hyde Park. Nancy in Hyde Park, you're on.
Good afternoon, Dr. Shartok. Assembly in Faso. I have a question.
He was. Now he's Congressman Faso.
Congressman Faso, sorry.
Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I was very concerned, Congressman Faso, by your vote to defund Planned Parenthood, despite the fact that you had asserted that you would not do so. I live in Dutchess County, and the local Planned Parenthood affiliate here serves 20,000 clients, most of whom are in your congressional district. 60% of them use Medicaid as their insurance. So when they go to a Planned Parenthood center, they receive a service, and they use their Medicaid insurance card for payment, much as we use our own insurance cards. Since you voted to prevent them from using their Medicaid cards to pay for services at Planned Parenthood, I'd like to hear where you think they'll get the health care services they obtained previously at Planned Parenthood. And before you begin, I'm aware that the talking point that the Republicans typically use when asked this question, that the men and women will be able to find services at community health centers, is a claim that earned two Pinocchios from the Washington Post for its inaccuracy. So given that community health centers won't be able to pick up these patients, what do you suggest they do to obtain the critical, often life-saving health care they now find at Planned Parenthood?
Well, Nancy, thank you for the call. My position has been plain on this right from the start. I said I did not support that provision. And in fact, in the Budget Committee, when I had an opportunity to vote to remove that provision from the bill, I did so. But I also told the representatives of Planned Parenthood that my ultimate vote on the legislation would not depend on whether or not that provision was in the bill. I believe that in the Senate, that provision is going to be up for grabs, and I think that if the bill comes out of the Senate, it is likely not to have that provision, but we don't know for sure. I agree that that provision, which doesn't fund abortion, federal money cannot be used to fund for abortion. This is strictly preventative services through Medicaid, that if an entity is organized and licensed by the state and they receive Medicaid, they agree to take Medicaid payment, they should be paid if they provide those particular services. And that's what I've said right from the get-go.
Yeah, but John, isn't Nancy right about the fact that you probably, since you were so, it was such an anathema to you, you should probably vote it against the whole bill because of your objections to the Planned Parenthood part?
No, because I think that the overall improvements that we're trying to make in the healthcare system are very significant. And again, I don't support that provision. And I believe that it has a high likelihood of coming out in the Senate.
Okay, but 24 million people, according to the CBOs, off the rolls. And everything I'm reading, analysis, New York Times, everywhere, is that the rich get richer and the poor are screwed under this bill.
Well, people want to play class warfare all they want. I mean, I spoke to a group yesterday in Kingston, and they basically say, you know, just keep taxing the rich. You know, Alan, if you confiscated the wealth of the 400 richest Americans in the country, you would cover the federal deficit, not the debt, the federal deficit for 4 years. Take away all of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and everyone else, the 400 richest Americans, take it all away. Just confiscate their wealth. Let's be like the Soviet Union. Take it all away, and in 4 years, all you've done is cover the deficit for 4 years. We have got to get economic growth in this country, and this notion that you can just, quote unquote, tax the rich and get prosperous is a fatuous one.
Yeah, but what
one.
About the fact that all the analysis shows that under the benefits of the new program, it's the rich who make out like bandits?
Alan, there are a number of taxes that are repealed in this legislation. The medical device tax is repealed. Even Elizabeth Warren wants to eliminate the medical device tax because it's hurt jobs and a very productive and important industry in our country. The taxes on insurers, the insurance plans, which are passed right through to policy payers, those taxes should be done away with. New York State, frankly, should do away with the taxes that it imposes on insurance plans. The one tax that raises the attention is the tax on capital gains, which is, I think, a 3.9% tax on capital gains that is a supplement in the ACA provision. And I think that has actually had a damaging effect upon the economy. I just don't think that that was a smart tax. And again, a lot of people just succumb to this kind of fatuous notion that we can just tax the rich and everything is going to be better. And that is just not true.
Nancy, thank you. We'll go now. He's been holding on for 17 minutes to Steve in Troy. All right, Steve in Troy, thanks for your patience. You're on.
Hello, Dr. Chartok and Congressman Fazio. I have a question about if you could briefly describe, Congressman, the health insurance that you receive as a benefit of being a member of Congress. How much does it cost you? What sort of benefits do you get? And secondly, whether or not you would be willing to forego that benefit and take your chances along with the rest of us.
I don't receive health benefits as a member of Congress because I had previously secured retiree health benefits from my service in the state of New York, for which I paid a lot of money to maintain that possibility. Most members of Congress are on the exchanges for which they receive their health care, but I do not. I do not receive that benefit. I am 64 years old, so I'm pretty rapidly approaching that Medicare age. So most members of Congress are receiving their health care through the exchanges.
Yes, but following up on this very good question, yep. And I know you have something to say about this, there were lots of stories about how the Congress people and their staffs were going to be included in on this, but that's changed, right?
Well, there was because of an amendment that was put in the bill, in order to pass the procedural rules in the Senate to have it within a budget reconciliation bill, there was a potential change in how health care for members of Congress would be covered. So what they did was we adopted a piece of legislation unanimously. All the Democrats voted for it and all the Republicans, which makes plain that Congress is covered by the provisions of this bill. And so Congress is not going to be exempt from any health care legislation.
Steve, thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, and let's go now to, Larry in Hancock, New York, who's been on the phone for a long time. Hi, Larry.
Hi, Alan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, Mr. Faso.
Hi, Larry.
I'm a resident of Delaware County, which I'm sure you know is one of the more financially stressed counties in your jurisdiction.
Yep.
I had a question regarding those with pre-existing conditions. I understand that access to coverage is there, but my concern is that if those of us with pre-existing conditions end up in the assigned risk pool, what would you expect the cost those with pre-existing conditions?
Larry, I ask you a question now? Where do you get your health insurance now?
I am currently on ACA.
Okay, so you're in an exchange plan under the ACA?
Correct.
Okay, so the pre-existing conditions are totally covered under this bill, and because you live in the state of New York, provisions in the state law would protect you as well. There was a very limited exemption or waiver that states could apply for. This would be states unlike New York, which wouldn't be permitted to do this under state law, a waiver on certain essential health benefits. But there are so many hoops that they have to jump through in order to qualify for that waiver. And the only way someone could, with a pre-existing condition, be subject to health underwriting, where you'd have to show what your health experience and the insurer might be able to charge you more, is if you didn't have continuous coverage. So if you maintain your coverage in your existing insurance, then you would have no risk here. But if you were in a position where continuous coverage was not maintained, then there was a special $8 billion fund that was added at the last minute. This was the so-called Upton Amendment, which would compensate and hold you harmless from any price increases for a pre-existing condition. But again, you'd have to be in a state where a governor requested a waiver. And again, you couldn't be in New York State where a governor could request that waiver because it would violate state law. And you would have to have dropped continuous coverage. And if you had dropped continuous coverage and you had a pre-existing condition, you would be compensated for any difference which the insurer would be able to charge you for a one-year period only. They'd be able to charge a higher rate, but only that 1 year. But you would be covered by this $8 billion fund that was created specifically to address this particular circumstance.
What do you mean by covered? So the actual impact?
Financial impact, yes. The financial impact to someone like yourself, if you did not maintain continuous coverage. Again, you'd have to be in a state where, unlike New York and most states, where state law didn't already protect you. But this is one of those features that has been grossly misrepresented by opponents of the legislation. And let me reassure you and the listeners that it is only this very narrow class of people who might be in a state where a governor requested a waiver, who then went through a very narrow set of circumstances, and the person didn't maintain continuous coverage. Then you would be compensated for any increase in costs that would affect you. And by the way, it could only be for a year that the insurer would be able to charge you more in that limited circumstance for a pre-existing condition. But financially, you would be covered, and your insurance would be, your provision of medical insurance would be covered as well.
Larry, thank you. Okay, now let's go to Anne in LaGrangeville. Okay, Anne in LaGrangeville, you're on.
Hi, Dr. Shartok. Nice speaking with you. Member of Congressman Faso.
Hi, Anne.
You said you were in Kingston yesterday. I was too, but I was in the evening and we missed you at the town hall meeting. I'm calling because I'm very confused by how this bill that was passed last Thursday got to be voted on. I know you have background as a lawyer, Mr. Faso, and I know that as a lawyer you're familiar with the concept of due diligence, of taking care and attention, being the most careful you possibly can, more than the average person. You're also a member of the Budget Committee, and you also wrote a section of the bill. I cannot understand, having all that responsibility, how this bill could be brought to the floor. Much of what I'm listening to, and at this point I have to say with a jaundiced ear, because I'm very disappointed in what's being done in Congress, seems to be speculation on your part. The concept that the people in New York cannot possibly be billed for pre-existing conditions could change, couldn't it, if the insurance companies which owned the policies, not those owned by New York State, but insurance companies, were to sell those policies to an insurance company, let's say in Wisconsin, where I believe the governor has already expressed an interest in waivers, and then that company, now operating out of Wisconsin, could charge New Yorkers for pre-existing conditions, could charge them what the market will bear.
Okay, let's leave that as the question, John.
Ann, you're wrong. That's just simply not correct. The insureds who are located in New York State are going to be governed by not just this federal law, but also by state law. And one of the things that is a necessary piece of this legislation, which we felt was important, was to try to return more regulatory responsibility for insurance, where it has historically been, to the states, but also to keep the provision or the concept that was contained in the ACA, which is to have federal resources brought to bear to lower premiums and deductibles for people. And that's why we have a total of $138 billion set aside to actually cover these high-risk self-insurance or reinsurance plans that will benefit premium holders and people who are having very high deductibles. Because, again, Anne, many, many people have been helped by the ACA, and I've talked to many of them, but many have been hurt. And so I'm trying to address, balance the needs of both segments in this process. And I readily concede that any legislation that Congress passes is not perfect, but the fear you're raising about having the New Yorkers be regulated by the state in another jurisdiction is simply unfounded.
Okay, so thank you for that. And I have a question for you then. If everybody is, John, is so, if everything you're saying is so true that everything is good, then how come all of these Republicans are saying, well, you know, when it gets to the Senate, they'll change it and make it better? And the senators are saying we're going to change it and make it better. How come?
Well, I think some of this is just posturing, but I do think that the fundamental pieces that will emerge from the Senate will be making sure that individuals who do not have employer-provided health insurance have the advance health credits, the subsidy that will be direct to the insurer to cover their costs. Right now, if you receive employer-provided health insurance in this country, you get a massive subsidy through the tax code because it's not taxable to you. 165 million people get their insurance that way, and they don't pay a tax on that subsidy. But if you work for a company that doesn't provide employer-provided health insurance, you get nothing.
So, but what about my question about the Senate?
I think this provision of advance health credits is going to emerge from the Senate as well. And the other thing that I think will emerge is some type of Medicaid per capita grant.
But why does it have to be changed if it's so good?
Well, I think that they'll be changed around the margins. But in my view, that they're not saying that.
They're saying we're starting all over.
Well, I think there's an element of posturing there. But I think the health credits that try to equalize the tax benefit for people who don't have employer-provided health insurance and the federally funded reinsurance pools that will lower premiums and deductibles for people. I think that's going to emerge from the Senate as well.
Okay, we'll see. Anyway, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back, everybody.
Support for WAMC comes from Agricultural Stewardship Association, helping people conserve farmland in the Upper Hudson Valley. We conserve good farmland for good forever. agstewardship.org. Carrie Haddad Gallery, presenting Gathering Ground, an exhibit of Hudson Valley landscape paintings and watercolors, graphic drawings, and cameraless photography. Now through June 19th, open daily. CarrieHaddadGallery.com. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie, presenting Animals in Bronze, the Michael and Mary Erlinger collection of animal ear bronzes from the Georgia Museum of Art. ArkellMuseum.org. And Coleman and Hartman Architects, serving residential and institutional clients with architecture designed for resilience and renewability. Designed for the next 100 years, CandHArchitects.com.
Okay, we are back. We're deluged. Everybody, every phone line is taken. We've gotten a ton of emails, but let me read you one, John. I'm a citizen of New Paltz and part of Move Forward New York. Question, how do you think it makes your constituents, feel to show up at town halls and not be able to get answers from their congressman? Also, what do you think of Maloney showing up in your place?
Well, the event they had last night was a partisan political event. The organizers of that event apparently tweeted an invitation to me about 5 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday. I already had an event last night that had been long scheduled, but I wouldn't have gone to that event anyway because it was a partisan political event. It was organized by unions who've never supported me, obviously. It was organized by the local Democratic Party and the Working Families Party and probably Citizen Action and groups that are all political adversaries. So. And Maloney coming there, Congressman Maloney, just 2 weeks ago, he pledged bipartisan working together. We appeared at a public forum at Marist College, and now he's rapidly changed his point of view and become a hyper-partisan. So I think that's unfortunate. I'm not going to act that way, but I've done this program with you to speak to people. I talk to newspapers all the time in my district. I've had over 250 meetings with constituents. I did a live televised town hall, which I guarantee you more people throughout my 11-county district from Vermont to Pennsylvania would be able to actually see, listen to a question and hear my answer than they would if I showed up at a hall with a few hundred people screaming. So that, I don't think, is particularly productive.
We're going to line number 9 with Mike, who's been very good about waiting. Thank you for your patience, Mike. Mike.
Hey, Alan and Congressman, thanks for taking my call.
Hi, Mike.
I just have a very simple question for the Congressman. How much money have you accepted from the healthcare lobby, especially recently? I was reading a report that indicated that they have been spreading money around, you know, like cow manure on a fresh field in the spring, in order to influence the voting on a bill that otherwise probably wouldn't have passed. So again, my question simply is, how much money have you accepted from the healthcare lobby?
Mike, I don't believe that I've received anything from what you broadly define as the healthcare lobby. I might be wrong in that regard, but nothing particularly stands out. And in fact, I think it's important to note that the healthcare insurance and the pharmaceutical lobbies were the big funders and backers of the ACA. So implicit in your question is a criticism which I reject because my vote is not influenced by any contributions. But candidly, I don't believe I've received any. I might have, but I'm not aware of it.
Mike, thank you. All right, we'll go to Nancy, who's been holding on for a half an hour. Okay, Nancy, your turn.
Yes, hi, Congressperson Faso.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, I have a question. First, I want to call you out on a few terms. I'm an English professor, so I'm sensitive to language, as you are as an attorney. So I want to call you out on using terms and normalizing terms like confiscating money from the rich. I would also like to call you out on using terms like posturing without giving any clear, definite definition of who and what is happening in terms of posturing. And I also would like to suggest that political adversaries are part of the political process, and that when Obamacare was being studied in 2009, there were plenty of political adversaries at town hall meetings. And I don't understand why you would be what I can only assume is timid about approaching political adversaries and needing to say what you're saying today on the phone in a safe environment to those people.
Okay, well, Nancy, we'll take that as a question. John?
I think you may be an English professor, but your political analysis is ridiculous, frankly.
Nancy, you won't stay on the phone for a single second if you don't listen to the answer.
I am not ridiculous.
You use the term, Nancy, call them out. So let's try to lower the temperature here.
Yeah, Nancy, the bottom line is that I meet with people who don't agree with me all the time. I answer questions from people that don't agree with me all the time. I talk to them in person, through meetings, through mail, through telephone. I had a televised town hall largely made up of people who didn't agree with me. So I'm not avoiding anything, but the fact is that the meeting last night, which was a political rally organized by political opponents, was not something that would have been a great place for me to go into. And I think I think it's apparent by the folks that were there. So if I had a rally or a meeting where it was just the Republican Party and the Conservative Party and people that agreed with me and showing up, and I had 400 people there, which I could get 400 people to show up who all agreed with me, I think someone like you might say, well, that wasn't that might be timid, too. So the fact is that I appreciate your discourse on English language. I don't think I was accusing anyone unduly of posturing, but I do think that your criticism is misplaced.
Nancy, go back to you. Go ahead.
Well, my question is, moving on, I'm wondering, did you and your staff read and deliberate on the bill fully before your vote? And if so, how long did it take?
Yes, I did. In fact, the main body of the bill was very similar or the same as the bill we voted on in the Budget Committee in March. I had plenty of opportunity to review it. And as someone I think may have mentioned, maybe you did or someone else, I did craft a particular provision of the bill, which would, as of 2020, eliminate the ability of New York State to impose its Medicaid costs on the counties and therefore on the homeowners. A typical homeowner in Dutchess County would save over $400 to $500 when my amendment is enacted into law after 2020. In Ulster County, about the same. And it would vary around the district. But in our district, $224 million is coming out of the pockets of homeowners and business owners who own commercial property to pay for the state's Medicaid costs. And I think that's outrageous. And just because Rocky did it 50 years ago doesn't mean we should continue it. I would give the state till 2020, over 2.5 years, to plan this transition. But it should eliminate finally this burden on the homeowners, because it's really hurting people all across our district. And I'm very proud of that amendment. But I read the whole bill. I read the subsequent amendments that were added. And again, there are provisions in the bill I don't agree with. But bottom line is that I hope that we can improve the legislation, but the legislation, I think, is an improvement over the existing law.
Okay, thank you, Nancy. All right, and we'll go to now, let's see here. I'm taking them all in absolute order. I want you all to know that. Okay, we'll go to Maggie in Stone Ridge. Maggie in Stone Ridge, you're on.
Good afternoon, Alan and Congressman Fasso.
Hi, Maggie.
First of all, I really want to make a correction about the event last night. I was at the event, and I went because it is the first time I have had an opportunity to have any kind of contact with you, Congressman Fasso, about a bill that you passed that affects my life completely. You work for us. We are your bosses. And that event last night was very well run, very respectful. People were concerned. Not everybody either can arrange their schedule to go onto a computer. You owe us a face-to-face opportunity where, yes, you may be uncomfortable with some of the provisions that people, the questions that people say or the statements that they say, and that is your choice. But it is also their choice to say it. Now, I understand you say you didn't get the invitation till last Friday at 5 o'clock. Then why wasn't your answer, gee, I can't do that night, but let's pick a date that I can do? Because it's important for me to have a face-to-face with my constituent. By the way, I live in your district. Yeah. And I am very disappointed in your promise that you broke to Andrea Mitchell. I watched your debate with Zephyr Teachout back during the election on Spectrum, and you stood there and you said, I grew up in this district and I will be there for every person in this district. You don't necessarily get to choose the only ways you get to be there. And I would like to know why you won't hold the town hall.
Okay, let's take that. Whoa. There are a lot of people behind you. Let's take that as the question.
Well, I think I've answered that question. I have had many forums where I've participated with people.
No,
I've had many.
Why won't you have a town hall? It's a simple question.
I actually did have a town hall. I had a televised town hall, and I'm looking to do a very similar event in the lower part of the district as well. But partisan political events are not something that I think is the best way to
get... No, it was not a partisan political event.
Whoa. Well, he let you speak. Now you let him speak.
I think if you look at the folks that organized it and how it was run, it was a partisan political event.
Well, I was there. And I was there because it was the only opportunity I've had to get any answers.
Well, Maggie, let me tell you, if you want to meet with me, call my office and I'll meet with you.
And you're on the phone with me.
I certainly will.
Okay.
Because
call my Kingston office.
Have no idea.
Call my Kingston office, Maggie, and I'd be happy to meet with you and address your concerns directly.
Thank you, Maggie. Okay. Now we're going to go. I'm looking for who's been on the longest. It's Andrea on line number two. Andrea, you're on.
Hi, good afternoon, Dr. Chartok and Congressman Faso. This is Andrea from Kinderhook. I'm a disabled Navy veteran, and I was the only woman on your Veterans Advisory Committee during the campaign.
Yes.
Since then, we have not had the opportunity to discuss issues facing the 50,000 veterans in the district, especially the approximately 5,000 women veterans. First, I'd like to know when the Vets Advisory Committee is going to reconvene, because we need to discuss how the AHCA affects veterans. A lot of veterans I know, both in the district and around the country, are terrified of losing access to affordable health care because of service-connected disabilities. The AHCA does away with a tax credit for 7 million veterans who are eligible but not enrolled in VA health care, and the VA secretary noted that he's concerned it might overwhelm both VA centers and the CHOICE program. Finally, the AHCA does nothing to guarantee affordable care for veterans with pre-existing conditions like PTSD or sexual trauma who are ineligible for VA care because of bad paper discharges, which are often associated with those conditions. How do you plan to ensure affordable health care for all veterans in the district?
Well, I am delighted that you called. We are looking at constituting our committee. We have been extremely busy with our Agricultural Advisory Committee and a number of other advisory committees that we're working with, but the Veterans is going to be meeting shortly, and we'll be in touch with you. And I think you raise very good questions, and we'll be addressing them as part of it. But pre-existing conditions are not changed in this legislation compared to the ACA.
Thank you, Andrea. Okay, let's go to Greg in Cooperstown. All right, Greg in Cooperstown, your turn.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just want to comment on the figures from the CBO, which are scary. They estimate that the price of for an average 64-year-old earning $26,500, after using a subsidy, the cost would jump from $1,600 a year to $14,600 under the ACHA. So the congressman voted for a revised bill, which the CBO did not give a revised report on. And I'm just asking how he can be sure that this bill does not unduly affect older Americans And I'd also like to know why there was such a rush to pass it, especially in light of the fact that the CBO never got a chance to weigh in on it.
Well, Greg, I did address this previously. We put a specific $80 billion fund to address the concern that the CBO had raised. That was a concern that I had and many others had about the effect on 50 to 64-year-olds, and we believe that that fund will be sufficient to greatly reduce any premium effect upon people between 50 and 64. It's a valid concern you raise, but we believe that the number and the amount of that subsidy will suffice to address that concern.
Okay, well, I was just concerned that you came up with that figure as far as how much to add to the fund to cover that before the report from the CBO on this revised bill came in.
Well, it was based on the CBO analysis that number was derived. So it is something that was done with specific reference to the concern that CBO had raised. But I would again point out that CBO has been off on their estimates on a number of occasions. But again, I don't say that as a criticism, just simply to say that it's very difficult to evaluate all the moving parts of the process. But we are definitely seeking to address that 50 to 64-year-old age group.
Greg, I'm so sorry. We got to we only have a couple of seconds now. So David in New Windsor, you're on. Okay, David in New Windsor, your turn.
Hi, John. I'd just like to thank you for your service and being so brave to pass this Affordable Care Act, because we are broke in this country and no one wants to realize that we just don't have free money. Even if we take all the money that you explained from Bill Gates and everybody else, we still don't have enough money to pay our debt. Isn't that amazing? It's amazing. I love you. Thank you.
Well, David, thank you. I don't know how you slipped through on the callers, but it's great, great to hear from you.
We take them in order. Okay, that's right. Okay, we'll go right now to Kim in Germantown. Kim, you're on.
Good afternoon. My question revolves around, of course, the AHAC and the restructuring of Medicare.
Kim, you only have a minute to ask your question, because, okay, and then he has a minute to answer. Go ahead.
Right. My concern is that his district contains more than 15 agencies that care for individuals with intellectual disabilities. How is he going to protect them?
Kim, it's a great question. One of the things that I fought for in this bill was to, in the per capita grant that the state will receive under Medicaid, again, the state is going to receive more money every year under Medicaid than it does the year before. It's not going to receive as much as they had anticipated, and there are a lot of reasons for that. I don't have, in a minute, enough reason or enough time to explain all that. But one of the things that we added was a specific provision saying that in the per capita grant, disabled people and those residing in nursing homes will receive an increase every year for medical inflation plus one. So we believe that that will be a sufficient increase for the disabled and for those who are residing in nursing homes. In my view, the people who are most in need, namely the disabled and people in nursing homes, and also medically fragile children, this was a provision that I wasn't able to get into this bill, but I did get an assurance from leadership that we would consider this later on in the year when we have to deal with other legislation, because there are 300,000 plus kids who have chronically and medically fragile conditions that I want to make sure that we're protected. So the least among us are the ones that I'm really focused on here and trying to, though, reduce premiums and deductibles for everyone.
Okay, well, thank you for that. We're out of time. Rosny and Jerry and Beth and Rose and Hannah and Kate, I do apologize. We left you on the air. A lot of people also sent in questions. John, I take it that I can ask you to promise that you'll come back again?
Definitely. I'd love to do it again.
Okay, so I want to thank you, John. And the support for Vox Pop comes from Intrum Healthcare, celebrating 46 years of in-home care. Support the Mohawk Hudson Land Conservancy in the grand opening of their Strawberry Fields Farm Nature Preserve on May 20th. IntrumHealthcare.com. The Tang Teaching Museum and Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. skidmore.edu/tang. The Preservation League of New York State presenting John Freeman Gill, author of Gargoyle Hunters, Friday, June 2nd, University Club of Albany. So our past has a future. Preserve New York State, NYS. PreserveNYS.org. And Waterwheel Village, Galway, New York, specializing in extra sharp New York cheddar since 1923, offering imported and domestic specialty cheeses, nostalgic candies, and more. WaterwheelVillage.com. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us on the Vox Pop. Our engineer has been the incomparable Zach Malloy. Your calls were answered by Colleen O'Connell and had our hands full today. Our producer, Jim Lavoulis. I'm Alan Chartok. Stay tuned now for a news update.